Welcome to the Security Nexus Deep Dive.
Great to be here.
Today, we're plunging into a stack of sources to understand a really critical challenge, maritime gray zone activity.
That's right. Specifically, how China is using these tactics, particularly in the South China Sea and increasingly the Indian Ocean region.
And we've got some solid material to work from, analysis from the Center for a New American Security, RAND Corporation reports, articles like one by Denny Roy in 1945 offering different takes.
Good mix.
Okay, let's jump in. This term gray zone, what exactly are we talking about based on these sources? It sounds, well, deliberately vague.
It is, and that's sort of the point. Sources like the RAND report, Understanding and Countering China's Maritime Gray Zone Operations, or the USNI Proceedings piece, the Hays Gray Zone, they describe it as coercive actions, actions taken below the threshold of what you'd normally consider conventional military conflict.
So pressure, but not outright fighting.
Exactly. The goal is to change the status quo, push boundaries, assert claims, but crucially, do it in a way that avoids triggering a direct military response from, say, the target country or its allies like the U.S.
Not war, definitely not peace. It's that really uncomfortable middle ground.
Precisely. The USNI article frames it as maybe an evolution in strategic competition for some actors. Less focus on, you know, decisive military battles and more on influencing political will, controlling the narrative, shifting the facts on the water, so to speak.
And our mission today is to unpack this.
Yeah.
Look at China's tactics, figure out why they're so tricky to counter.
Yeah.
And then explore the strategies the U.S. and its partners are trying or thinking about.
Right. We want to pull out the core insights from all this material.
Okay, let's start with China's goals here. What are they trying to achieve in the maritime space, according to these sources?
Well, the CNAS report, Countering Coercion, by Lisa Curtis and Nalanthi Samarnayake, and the RAND work lay out a few key things. First, asserting those sweeping claims, like the Nine Dash Line, which, you know, covers most of the South China Sea.
A claim not recognized under international law.
Not at all. They also aim to establish control, or at least dominance, in areas within other countries' exclusive economic zones, their EEZs. Think resources, fishing rights.
So taking control of resources that legally belong to others.
Effectively, yes. Beyond that, it's about protecting their own economic interests, like shipping lanes, projecting power outwards, and gathering intelligence.
And they've developed a particular structure for this 3C force concept.
Yes, that's a really important point from the RAND report. China uses three main arms. The People's Liberation Army Navy, the PLAN, that's their actual military navy. Then there's the China Coast Guard, the CCG. And finally, the People's Armed Forces Maritime Militia, the PAFMM.
Okay, Navy, Coast Guard, Militia. How does that work in the gray zone?
Well, this is where it gets clever, strategically. Mm. The RAND analysis shows that very often it's the CCG and the Maritime Militia, these supposedly non-military or law enforcement assets that are on the front lines during incidents, harassing fishing boats, blocking resupply missions.
Ah, so it gives Beijing deniability. It wasn't our Navy.
Exactly. They can claim it's just Coast Guard enforcement or even, you know, civilian fishing boats acting on their own. It keeps the PLAN, the actual Navy, sort of over the horizon as a backup threat, especially against smaller nations.
So they can apply pressure without it immediately looking like military aggression.
Precisely. It keeps things murky, below that threshold for a strong military response. Now, RAND does point out that when it comes to confrontations with, say, U.S. vessels, the PLAN is much more likely to be involved directly. But against regional neighbors, often it's the CCG and militia.
And this China Coast Guard isn't just any Coast Guard, right? It's become quite formidable.
Oh, absolutely. The RAND report details its huge growth and militarization. It's now the largest Coast Guard in the world. Its ships are getting bigger, more capable. Many have PLAN officers integrated. They're equipped with things like high-pressure water cannons that can cause real damage, and even naval guns, sometimes up to 76 millimeters.
Wow. And then there's the physical aspect, the island building.
Right. The sources all mention this. Since around 2014, China undertook this massive island building campaign. Dredging sand, building artificial islands on disputed reefs and shoals. We're talking thousands of acres reclaimed.
And putting military facilities on.
Dual-use facilities, yes. Harbors, airfields, radar installations. These effectively become forward bases, allowing them to sustain a presence, project power, and support these gray zone operations much farther from the Chinese mainland.
Okay, so where are we seeing these tactics being used most intensely right now?
The South China Sea is ground zero, really. The CNAS report is very clear about that being the primary theater.
And the Philippines seems to be facing a lot of heat recently.
It really is. Both the CNAS report and other analyses, like in 1945, really zero in on the pressure campaigns against the Philippines, especially around Second Thomas Shoal, where they have that grounded World War II ship, the BRP Sierra Madre, serving as an outpost.
What does that pressure actually look like? What are the Chinese vessels doing?
The reports, especially RAND's, get into specifics. We're talking about Chinese Coast Guard and militia vessels engaging in really aggressive actions against Philippine ships trying to resupply the Sierra Madre.
Like what?
Dangerous maneuvers, cutting them off, physically blocking their path, and the very prominent use of those high-pressure water cannons we mentioned.
And these water cannons aren't just symbolic.
No, not at all. RAND notes past incidents where they've caused significant damage to the Philippine vessels and actually injured crew members. It's a physical, coercive tool.
That's pretty intense. Is it only the Philippines experiencing this?
No, unfortunately not. The CNAS report gives other examples. Tactics like swarming areas with huge numbers of fishing vessels, like near Whitsun Reef, effectively intimidating others away, harassing Vietnamese vessels involved in oil and gas exploration in their own waters. The RAND report also details standoffs with Indonesian vessels over fishing rights near the Natuna Islands.
And you mentioned earlier, this isn't just a South China Sea issue anymore.
Yeah.
The Indian Ocean region is also seeing activity.
That's a growing area of focus in the sources, yes. Highlighted in the CNAS report by Curtis and Samer and Ayak, and Miranda touches on it too. China's presence in the IOR is clearly expanding beyond just, say, trade protection.
What kind of presence?
Increased naval ship deployments, so-called research vessels, which often have intelligence gathering roles, large distant water fishing fleets operating there, and of course their established military logistics base in Djibouti.
Any specific incidents causing concern?
The sources mention worries raised by things like Chinese submarine visits to ports in the region and the docking of these advanced research or tracking ships widely suspected of dual-use intelligence capabilities in places like Sri Lanka and the Maldives. It signals a broadening strategic footprint.
Okay, so the tactics are pretty clear. The objectives seem clear.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the rub. Why is this gray zone stuff so hard to actually counter?
That's the core problem, isn't it? Both CNAS and RAND identify the fundamental challenge. It's the grayness itself. Because these actions are designed to stay below that threshold of armed attack, traditional deterrence, you know, the threat of military retaliation just doesn't work as effectively.
You can't really launch missiles because someone used a water cannon or shouldered your ship.
Exactly. Responding with conventional military force risks massive unwanted escalation. China's strategy exploits this ambiguity. It uses non-traditional actors like the militia and non-lethal but coercive tactics. This really complicates things for nations, especially democracies operating under strict rules of engagement in international law.
And the sources mentioned differing views on the rules themselves.
Right. The CNAS report points this out. There are fundamental disagreements between China and the U.S. and its allies about sovereignty claims, the interpretation of international law like UNCLOS, and what constitutes acceptable maritime behavior. China operates under a different set of assumptions and claims.
Which must make it even harder for smaller nations in the region.
Immensely harder. They often lack the capacity, the number of ships, the resources to effectively push back against China's Coast Guard or militia swarms without risking a dangerous escalation they simply can't afford. CNAS makes that challenge very clear.
I did see an interesting point in that 1945 article by Denny Roy. China is trapped in the South China Sea gray zone.
Mm-hmm.
He suggested Beijing might actually be somewhat stuck in this policy.
Yeah, Roy's argument is interesting. He suggests that while China's actions are creating problems, they're unlikely to significantly change course soon. Partly, he argues, because backing down now would be seen internally as a major defeat, which is politically unacceptable. And their whole national narrative makes it very difficult to admit their actions might be expansionist or violate international norms.
So domestic politics plays a big role.
It seems to. And Roy also touches on another angle that these gray zone actions can be seen as ways for China to test the waters, so to speak.
Testing U.S. commitments.
Yes. Probing the strength and reliability of U.S. security guarantees to its allies in the region. Seeing how far they can push before eliciting a strong, unified response.
Okay. Given all these difficulties, what are the sources suggesting? What strategies are being discussed or employed to counter this playbook?
Well, the CNAS report frames it as finding that tricky balance you need to deter the coercion, but you also desperately want to avoid stumbling into a military conflict.
A fine line to walk.
Very fine. The RAND report talks about needing an integrated deterrence strategy, one that doesn't just focus on preventing a big war, but also specifically addresses this persistent below-threshold gray zone activity.
Right. So what does that integrated approach look like in practice, according to the sources?
It seems to break down into a few key areas. First, presence operations.
Like freedom of navigation operations, FONPs.
FONOPs are part of it, yes. Sailing warships through disputed waters to assert navigation rights under international law. RAND acknowledges these are necessary signals, but they also suggest that just sailing through quickly might not be enough on its own to stop the day-to-day harassment.
So we need more than just drive-bys.
Potentially. RAND discusses what some call a maritime counterinsurgency or enhanced maritime presence model. The idea here is more about sustained presence, staying near an area where harassment is happening, providing overwatch.
Is there an example of this working?
They point to the West Capella incident back in 2020. A Malaysian drill ship was being harassed by Chinese vessels, and U.S. and Australian warships stayed in the vicinity for some time. Apparently, the Chinese pressure eventually eased off.
Interesting. So what are the recommendations related to presence?
RAND suggests things like maybe increasing the frequency and publicizing FONOPs more, and seriously considering adopting that sustained presence model more widely, possibly using U.S. Coast Guard ships or even small naval task groups specifically to shadow and support partners' vessels when they're being harassed. Though they do note the U.S. isn't currently directly escorting those Philippine resupply missions to Second Thomas Shoal.
Okay, presence is one element. What else? Transparency initiatives really seem to be gaining traction.
Huge emphasis on this in both RAND and CNAS. The core idea is simple. Shine a bright light on what China is doing. Publicize the aggressive behavior, the violations of international norms.
Yeah. Oh, what does that achieve?
It helps counter Beijing's narrative, their disinformation. It builds international awareness and condemnation. And importantly, it generates support for the nations being targeted. It makes it harder for China to claim they're just enforcing laws or that these are isolated incidents.
And the Philippines has really leaned into this, haven't they?
They've been the pioneers here, absolutely. RAND specifically highlights their assertive transparency campaign. What they've done is embed journalists, photographers, videographers directly onto their Coast Guard vessels during these tense resupply missions.
So they get footage out immediately.
Yes. Often releasing videos and accounts very quickly, sometimes almost in real time. It's been incredibly effective at showing the world very graphically what Chinese vessels are doing, the water cannons, the blocking maneuvers. Raymond Powell and Benjamin Gorogolzari's work has really emphasized how impactful this has been.
How are U.S. transparency efforts looking?
RAND says the U.S. does some of this, like releasing videos of unsafe intercepts by Chinese aircraft or ships. But they also point out some inconsistencies. Maybe not always using press embeds effectively. Reports that sometimes the release of information gets slowed down or softened by higher level policy concerns and just general resource constraints, staffing, budgets for the relevant public affairs offices.
So the recommendation is more transparency, more consistently.
Pretty much. RAND suggests being more proactive with U.S. communications, actively supporting and amplifying the transparency efforts of allies like the Philippines, and even considering declassifying intelligence when possible to corroborate incidents and expose malign activities.
Makes sense. Okay, a third key strategy seems to be supporting allies and partners.
Absolutely fundamental. You can't counter this effectively alone. RAND details efforts already underway to build up the capacity of Southeast Asian partners, their navies, their coast guards, through joint training and exercises, providing better equipment and technology. Think about the expanded U.S. access to bases in the Philippines under EDCA, specific support for Indonesia's maritime security, Japan providing new patrol vessels to the Philippine Coast Guard, things like that.
And helping them actually see what's going on out there. Maritime domain awareness.
Yes, enhancing MDA is crucial. A big challenge in the gray zone is that militia vessels often turn off their AI's transponders, their tracking systems, to operate covertly. So initiatives like the Quad's Indo-Pacific Partnership for Maritime Domain Awareness, or IPMDA, aim to fuse satellite data, radar, and other sources to give partners a clearer picture.
I saw RAND even mentioned using fishing fleets.
Yeah, kind of a creative idea exploring ways to potentially enlist the vast network of regional fishing boats themselves as sensors, feeding information back.
The U.S. Coast Guard seems like a natural fit for a lot of this partner capacity building and even presence. Are they equipped for it?
They're ideally suited in terms of mission and skills, but RAND identifies a major constraint: resources. Mm-hmm. They emphasize a critical need for the U.S. Coast Guard to have significantly more ships, personnel, and funding dedicated to the Indo-Pacific if they're going to effectively support partners and maintain the kind of persistent presence being discussed. Current budgets are stretched thin.
And underpinning all of this partner support is trust, right? Trust in U.S. commitment.
That is absolutely paramount and sometimes fragile. RAND points back to the 2012 Scarborough Shoal incident, where the perception in some quarters was that the U.S. brokered a deal for both sides to withdraw, but then didn't ensure China followed through, which they didn't.
So that damaged confidence.
It raised questions. Sources like Lisa Curtis's work stressed the need for absolutely clear, consistent, unequivocal statements and actions from the U.S., demonstrating commitment to its allies' security. This is vital to counter China's narrative that the U.S. isn't a reliable partner.
Okay, one last area the sources explore: non-lethal weapons, NLWs. That sounds interesting in a gray zone context.
It is. Both RAND and a related white paper from the Joint Intermediate Force Capabilities Office, GIFQO, called War Without Gunsmoke, look at NLWs as potential tools that fit perfectly into this gray zone space, tools that have an effect but operate below the threshold of lethal force.
What kind of tools are we talking about? Give me some examples.
Okay, things like powerful long-range acoustic devices or LRODs acoustic hailers that can deliver very loud, clear warnings or even uncomfortable noise levels. Dazzling lasers designed to temporarily impair vision or overload optical sensors. Millimeter wave systems like the active denial system, which project a beam that causes an intense but non-damaging heating sensation on the skin, making people want to move away. And even developing tech-like ways to stop small boat engines by fouling their propellers.
How would these help in, say, a standoff with militia boats?
Well, RAND suggests they offer options for what they call escalation management. Instead of having only two choices, do nothing or use potentially lethal force, these tools give commanders or ship captains ways to respond to harassment or enforce rules that have a real impact, impose a cost, but don't risk starting a shooting war. They allow you to push back without crossing that gunsmoke line.
Seems logical. Why aren't they more widely used then? Are there barriers?
Yes, the sources identify several hurdles. One is cultural. Within large military organizations like the DoD, there can be a strong emphasis on lethal capabilities. Mm-hmm. There are also policy gaps. How exactly do these tools fit into rules of engagement for gray zone scenarios? Some technologies aren't fully mature yet. And then there are real logistical and policy challenges in actually sharing these kinds of technologies with partners.
So work to be done there.
Definitely. RAND highlights the need to develop clearer concepts of Operation Kono PS, basically the doctrine and procedures for how these non-lethal tools would actually be employed effectively and safely in these complex maritime situations.
Wow. Okay, this really paints a picture of just how complex this is. China's strategy is layered, it's ambiguous by design, using this mix of forces.
It absolutely is. And the takeaway from the sources is that countering it effectively demands an equally sophisticated, multifaceted response. It can't just be a military answer. It needs integration across diplomatic channels, information campaigns, economic levers, and critically, working closely with allies and partners.
And the stakes couldn't be higher, really. We're talking about upholding international law, respecting sovereignty, ensuring access to resources, freedom of navigation, and just maintaining stability in incredibly vital regions of the world. So to wrap up, we've taken a deep dive through these sources, looking at China's gray zone tactics, the significant challenges they pose, and this whole suite of potential counter strategies, boosting presence, shining a light through transparency, empowering partners, and maybe even employing new non-lethal tools. It's clearly a dynamic, ongoing competition in that messy space between peace and war.
It really is. And, you know, if you accept that idea, maybe from the Sherbico paper related to the RAND work, that gray zone conflict is essentially war without gunsmoke, a way to achieve strategic aims without triggering large-scale fighting, it leaves us with a really tough question, doesn't it? How do nations that are committed to playing by the rules, to upholding international law and avoiding escalation, how do they impose real, meaningful costs on an aggressor in this gray zone? How do you compel them to change their behavior without actually crossing that threshold yourself and igniting the very conflict you're trying to prevent?
That's a deeply challenging question to think about. A lot to mull over there. Thank you for walking us through all of this.
My pleasure. It's a critical topic.
And for everyone listening, you can find more information and dig deeper into the topics and sources we discussed today at thesecuritynexus.net.
Thanks for joining us on the Security Nexus Deep Dive.